relationship, or if they don't plead facts that show the best interest, then the court can dismiss the petition. And I think that, I would hope that would handle your objections.
Representative Bond.
Is it clear that it's limited to those fact circumstances, though? If they don't plead that, they'd have to plead that on the face. What you're saying is they'd have to plead it on the face of whatever instrument, or the judge could throw it out. But if they've pled it, you're saying that this amendment wouldn't be used then by the judge to say there is not sufficient best interest of the children to prove it out. What would keep the judge from doing that?
The judge could look at the pleadings, decide whether it reflected that it was in the best interest. If he decided it was not, he could boot them out. If he decided that they have pled facts which allege that it's in the best interest of the child, then it would go to a hearing.
Representative Bond.
Just say that on the face of the instrument it is pled that it's in the best interest of the child. If the amendment were accepted in its original form, is there anything that would keep the judge from just ruling that it wasn't in the best interest of the child and booting the case out?
Certainly not. A judge can rule any way he wants. I suppose the only thing that keep him from doing it is the embarrassment of being reversed on appeal.
I guess I'm having trouble.
She did that to me in her divorce case. She appealed me and got me reversed.
I guess I'm having trouble understanding if where the judge would normally kick it out is where it wasn't pled on the face. As a matter of course, everybody's just going to plead it on the face of the instrument, and then that portion of the amendment is meaningless.
Well, that's why we have in here facts. They've got to plead facts, not just simply that it is in the best interest of the child, but they've got to plead facts showing it's in the best interest of the child. Representative Bunn, it's a difficult area, and clearly if somebody else can find a better way to do it, we just want to kick those cases out that really don't belong in court.
Well, do you believe that there are a lot of cases? Now, I can understand clearly the first part of the amendment. I think it's one you can get a good handle on, and the pleadings can help you resolve that one. But are you really going to be able to get at that second part successfully through the amendment the way it's written there? I mean, are you really going to be able to get rid of that many cases that shouldn't come?
It would be my hope that we could. It would be my hope. What they're concerned about is they're concerned that if they come up with a plan for a child and it's an excellent plan, everybody supports it, that everything comes to a screeching halt because the foster parents who've had the child for a period of time decide that they've now fallen in love with the child and want it, or if some shirt-tail relative, and boy, I've seen this happen a lot, decides that, well, that child's not going to be put up for adoption. We want that child. It's trying to cut out that kind of case. I'm not claiming this is the best way in the world, and clearly if somebody come up with something better, I'm more than happy to go along with it.
Well, there's a reverse side of that coin. In 1975, I served on the Human Resources Committee here in the legislature, and we had a very strong concern at that time and held some hearings on the concern that foster parents wanted to adopt children, and that at that time there was an unwritten policy that we wanted to keep those foster homes in effect there. We had a shortage of foster homes and were discouraging foster parents from adopting children, and that final portion of the amendment would actually militate against parents who came in and said, we want a hearing on this issue. It would be an easier way for CSD to get those parents out of their hair. And frankly, it appears to me that there are some legitimate areas where those parents ought to have a full hearing, where the parents and their lawyer may agree and CSD may not agree. Do you see that as a legitimate concern?
I think the point is, ultimately, for them to prevail, they've got to show that it is in the best interest of that child that they have that child. And clearly, if they can't plead it, they're not going to be able to prove it.
I can't imagine a situation where a parent, a foster parent, or some other person couldn't plead that final portion of the amendment. I mean, I can't, it's so rare in my mind as an attorney that I couldn't come up with language to sufficiently plead that to get through the front door.
I'll give you an example. A kid that was put up for termination of parental rights, put in an adoptive foster care home, exceptionally outstanding home, everything was going along fine, and I went through about 6 months, of an intervention by some 80-year-old grandparents living on welfare in a one-bedroom shack about 60 miles outside Pendleton. Now, clearly, I don't think they would be able to plead best interest of a child. They clearly should not have a 2-year-old child.
Well, without knowing more, I wouldn't be ready to foreclose them at the front door,
Okay, is there further discussion or questions? Representative Phillips.
Can I ask Representative Fund? I think this is just a tremendously good policy statement for some reasons that I've been involved in, some cases that I thought some individuals should have standing and didn't. So from a policy standpoint, this is a good move as far as I'm concerned. The amendment, as you've proposed it, obviously if somebody came in, stated their case initially and showed some at least initial evidence that there was some emotional tie creating the relationship, you feel that's then sufficient to give, so it can go back and for further hearing. And at that point, they would then be able to plead their case on the true best interest of the family. And obviously, if I was from proving my case standpoint, a non-legal, but if I was to set this out in the first place to get the judge's attention, I would list all the great things I was going to provide the child anyway, and or the individual involved. So it's your case, you're stating we amend this and drop that wording out. It's going to be there in the first place, and these are going to be relatively rare cases, as far as I can determine, and that they ought to have their day in court if they can provide any evidence that they have some sort of emotional tie. Is that what I understand?
Well, the first part of the motion says that they've got to state a prima facie case for emotional ties, which says they've got to put on the written documents that there are emotional ties. I don't read the second part as coming that same way, and that may be part of the problem is the wording, but as I read it, it says a motion for intervention may be denied if intervention is not in the best interest of the child. It doesn't speak to how it's pled or anything. It just says a judge looks and says a motion may be denied if intervention is not in the best interest of the child. And I have a problem with that because it doesn't set up any standards. And I think the end result is a lot of people will be wanting to get a hearing saying, I think it's best for this child to be with me, and CSD will be telling them before.
I might add, we have changed it since this was handed in to read, or does not allege facts that the intervention is in the best interest of the child.
I have no problem with that language, because anyone can allege facts, in my opinion.
Okay, that's what we're suggesting. In other words, it goes out if they don't allege facts that it's in the best interest, or it goes out if they don't allege ties to the child.
Mr. Chairman, I would accept that as a friendly amendment. And,
okay, why don't we go ahead. Judge, could you state that again so we can get that?
In other words, it would read in full, a motion for intervention may be denied, or a petition may be denied, or a petition may be dismissed on the motion of any party or on the court's own motion if the petition does not state a prima facie case of emotional ties creating a parent-child relationship, or does not allege, this is the new part, or does not allege facts that the intervention is in the best interest of the child.
Okay. Has everyone got that? Okay.
Representative Springer, if I could just, I noticed that I made a mistake in copying this over, and I repeated a phrase that doesn't need to be repeated. At the beginning of the amendment, it says a motion for intervention may be denied, or a petition may be denied. That "or a petition may be denied" shouldn't be in there. That was just a copying error. So it should just read a motion for intervention may be denied, or a petition may be dismissed.
Okay. We'll accept those as friendly amendments to the amendments that you folks are advocating. Is everyone clear on the language that we're dealing with at this time? Okay, I think the chair would move adoption of the amendments. Now, I'm not sure about the numbering of the sections or if LC is going to want to reconstruct this in terms of how it's actually prepared, but we will ask council to work with LC, obviously, on the amendments, and if necessary, we'll review it with members individually to make sure the language LC adopts reflects our intent here. I would like to move it, though, at least conceptually, get it to the floor rather than hold it over for another committee work session. The chair would move those amendments. Is there any further discussion? Council?
I just want to make sure the committee's had a chance to see that it's not just this paragraph, it's the subsequent paragraph also that they're offering. That's all.
Okay. Any objection to those amendments? If not, they're adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Phillips.
Of the amendments that were moved on, added into it, I want to be sure we all read that and noted that they're asking for continuity for two or more years.
Right.
Okay.
Well, not necessarily. That is prima facie. They can show ties in other ways.
That's not the only trigger, if I understand it.
Yeah. Okay.
On its face, that doesn't. But you can allege other facts if proven would be sufficient to establish it. I guess you could get down to who knows what, months.
Okay. I just because that would make me uncomfortable if that was the only, if that was the cutoff. Anything else?
Sort of becomes a rebuttable presumption.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative Bellamy? I would move Hospital 2460 as amended to the floor.
Thank you. Representative Bellman moves House Bill 2460 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellman?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Kretzky?
Aye.
Miller? Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Representative Phillips? Like the privilege here?
I wouldn't accept that.
Okay. Senate Bill 176.
All right. This is a bill that's come from the Senate, and the subcommittee heard it. It has not been amended in any way. I do use staff measure analysis written by the Senate co-counsel Jack Morris. Basically, this is a bill that intends to solve two problems. The first problem is that, according to the Children's Services Division, the juvenile courts have interpreted the juvenile pre-adjudication standards to apply to escapees as well as pretrial detainees. CSD states that because of this, escapees who are picked up are often released after 2 hours. I think those of you who are at the juvenile detention standards hearing in Portland are probably aware of those standards and what kind of effect they've had on juveniles. This makes it difficult for, they also have, escapees are picked up in other states but are released after a few hours. So they've got those two problems. They've got escapees here in the state and they've got people outside of the state. The Senate amended the original bill in two ways. First of all, they amended ORS 420.490 to give CSD the authority to hold escaped juveniles. The amendments that they added to the bill clarify and reinforce this power. And then the second amendment they did to solve the out-of-state escapee problem was to amend RS 420.910 also to allow the superintendent of the school to issue an arrest warrant for the juvenile. Finally, the court has also given the power to issue an arrest warrant. At subcommittee, this was voted from subcommittee to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. There was only one issue, as I recall, that was left dangling, not in terms of any amendments, but just an issue, and that was Representative Kopinski's question about whether the superintendent should have reasonable grounds to believe to issue that arrest warrant or whether it should be probable cause. At the subcommittee last hearing, I advised the committee that it was based on the Morrissey versus Brewer case, which I have a copy of today, and I read it today to see what the Supreme Court said. They basically said reasonable grounds are the right terminology for someone, for a superintendent to determine whether they ought to issue a warrant. However, if you read the case carefully, they also talk about probable cause. I did talk to the juvenile rights people, and they don't have any strong opposition to changing it from reasonable grounds to probable cause if you desire to do that, Representative Kopetsky. But I think in reading the decision, the law as it reads now is very much in conjunction with that decision. It doesn't have a fiscal impact and there isn't any subsequent referral.
Thank you. Representative Kopetsky?
Just a question. Are you saying then, counsel, that reasonable grounds in this situation is the same level standard as probable cause?
Am I saying it's the same?
Yes.
No, I'm not saying that.
No.
I'm saying the Supreme Court looked at parole and probation revocations and made a decision as to what was necessary for due process to take place. And what they said is it'll be sufficient, therefore, in a parole revocation context if an evaluation of whether reasonable cause exists to believe that conditions of parole have been violated is made by someone other than a parole officer. In other words, they use the language reasonable grounds as a basis for making a determination whether you should arrest
someone. So,
Representative Kopinski.
So what you're saying is the Supreme Court said that this is the minimum standard necessary?
Right.
Thank you.
I am saying that. That's true.
Okay. Representative Bowen.
Mr. Chairman, there is an issue that I just want to raise very briefly that could be dealt with in this bill or Senate Bill 264, which is coming up tomorrow. But I'll mention the concern. There are facilities like Rainbow Lodge and McMinnville or others that are a post-adjudication juvenile care facility. And presently, under legislation passed last session, if a child is in that facility having been sent there by the judge and they run away, they can't be detained. They're simply returned there and can smile in the face of the director and say, see you again, and run away again, and there's just no control situation. And I want to propose at some point amendments for a very limited detention in order for the facility to have some kind of control element. And I think so as not to take time in holding this bill up, I'll send a letter to the committee tomorrow on Senate Bill 264 to suggest that.
I think 264 would probably be more appropriate since it deals with post-adjudicative detention standards. So appreciate that comment. Representative Kopetsky, any motions?
Well,
going,
Mr. Chair, I guess I think this is something I would move to. Did I make this motion to subcommittee, or did we decide to wait?
Yes, Representative Kopetsky, you did make the motion to subcommittee.
And was it voted on?
Oh, are you talking about probable cause versus reasonable cause? No, you did not move it, and it wasn't voted on. You just discussed it. You asked me to do some research.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move terms line 20 and 21 to delete reasonable grounds and insert probable cause.
Okay, Representative Kopetsky moves to delete the language reasonable grounds and substitute, therefore, language probable cause. Is there further discussion? Representative Bond?
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I could just inquire, it seems to me that the whole juvenile area is a somewhat more informal process than the adult law, and that it may be a bit more difficult to establish probable cause in that atmosphere than in a fully adult system. In that sense, I'd have some reluctance to move from reasonable cause to probable cause, but I'd be glad to hear any comments on the reason for shifting.
Representative Kopetsky?
Well, I think what we're talking about is one more phone call or one more checking to see if the person really has escaped. I really don't quite understand why it wouldn't be probable cause. I mean, the person's either gone or they're not gone. We're asking other states to recognize and honor warrants, and I don't know if they ever look up our law or anything, but it seems that they can recognize probable cause, and I have a fairly good idea of what that means, and give more credence to our statute. It's my understanding that other states kind of ignore these types of requests in current law.
Okay, is there further discussion or comment? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
No.
Lund?
No.
Hill?
Aye.
Gretzky?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
No.
Springer?
Aye. Motion fails. 5 votes to amend the full committee. Sorry, Representative. Further, forget the witty committee award. Further amendments on the bill? Any motion to the floor?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kopetsky?
I put Senate Bill 176 to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Kopetsky moves Senate Bill 176 Kane Gross to the floor for the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll. Representative Miller, we're voting on Senate Bill 176 Kane Gross unamended.
Good.
The juvenile escape bill. Clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Run?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Gretzky?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Motion's adopted. Any volunteers on this?
Mr. Chair.
Kopetsky?
Yeah. Make up for my foolish amendment there.
Okay, let's take up the licensing house bill or motor vehicle uninsured driver bill 2757 next. Council?
All right, this is a bill which basically tries to close the loopholes on people who are cited in court for having no insurance, who purchase insurance, and then after they've had their court appearance, cancel their insurance. It was presented to the subcommittee by Representative Bunn. The subcommittee heard the bill and discussed the problem of, say, a good faith driver who had acted in good faith but didn't have the documentation. And so Representative Bunn worked with the Department of Motor Vehicles to come up with an amendment that would take care of a good faith driver. The Department of Motor Vehicles also suggested language be added to allow the division to exempt an owner from filing proof of future financial responsibility and to waive that $25 reinstatement fee if it is later shown that the owner's vehicle was insured at the time of the random sampling. And that idea was also incorporated into the amendments. In addition, there were a couple of other amendments. One was to change one chapter reference, which apparently was incorrect, and the last part of it was were to delete the words upon any highway in section 6 of the bill. I'd like all of those amendments were adopted in subcommittee, and the bill was referred to full committee with a due pass recommendation. As a side note, this section 6, where the words upon any highway were deleted. I want you to know that Representative Miller, through either foresight or hindsight, caught the same language in Senate Bill 102 when it went to the before it went to the floor, and we made the same amendment in that bill, so they're mirror images, because this bill and that bill amended the same section in the same way.
I would move House Bill 2757 to the floor, do pass as amended.
Thank you. Representative Bunn moves House Bill 2757 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. And I believe, Representative Bunn, that we in committee need also to adopt as part of the committee report your recommendation that the bill, when printed and grossed, include as sponsors all those sponsors on the five bills that originally dealt with this subject. Okay. The further discussion on the motion?
Just, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure procedurally if you can do that coming out of committee. Can you?
It's just a recommendation out of committee.
That's our recommendation. Oh. Now, we'll double check with the Chief Clerk's office and see actually how that's accomplished. But I think,
well, Mr. Chairman, in line with what's occurred on the floor before, both parties have agreed to the sponsors of bills being allowed to have their names added. So I would see no problem with that occurring.
I'm not aware of any. We'll just make sure we're following the proper procedure in doing so. But I think if that's endorsed in the committee as part of our recommendation, we're on much better footing than trying to take motions on the floor, which sometimes run into problems. Further discussion on the motion.
Well, could I just clarification? Are you saying, Mr. Chair, that names would be included prior to the printed and gross version or the motion on the floor? Bill is up for third reading.
I don't know, Representative Kopetsky.
Oh, sure.
We're going to check the Chief Clerk's office.
Yes. Sure, it will be the latter.
I might indicate for the committee, I checked very carefully on that on the open primary because Representative Jolin was very concerned about the issue, and we got a definite, unequivocal answer that it had to be done on the floor after careful review. But it did not stop the committee from recommending that occurring on the floor.
Great. Thank you for that clarification. Any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Bellamy?
Aye.
Bunn?
Aye.
No, he left.
Excused.
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Phillips?
Aye.
Scranton? Aye. Representative Bunn, like the honors on this? Okay, Senate Bill 573.
Also a bill that's come from the Senate. You have the Senate staff measure analysis before you because we didn't amend the bill in subcommittee. Basically, it's a bill that's designed to stop any thieving of logs in the forest. One of the issues that was asked at the subcommittee that really wasn't resolved before we came to the full committee is what effect this might have on people that were going into the forest and getting logs for firewood or possibly buying a whole log from somebody for firewood. And I'd like to report back the information I have. I don't have a completely definitive answer, but I talked to Mr. Miller in forestry, and he said that the bill, as it's written, is not intended to affect people out getting firewood. It would affect those hauling whole logs for firewood purposes, but those kinds of people are rare since most people do not have the means to do this. But those who own log trucks and are hauling logs for delivery to individuals are already required to meet the branding and permit requirements before they can haul them out of the woods. I talked with Mr. John Hauser to find out whether log is defined in the APA Forestry Administrative Rules. The answer is not defined. And also talked with Mr. Gruber about the impact of the bill on firewood purposes, and he couldn't see a problem, but he wasn't really clear as to what it was about. Also looked at Kip Lombard's bill. Was unable to get a copy of it, but do have sort of a relating to clause about firewood. But having talked to Mr. Miller in forestry, who had read the bill, I think I can say to the committee that it should not affect those people who are out getting firewood.
Representative Kopetsky, are you satisfied, or do you want to do some more research on this subject?
Might want to define log, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kopetsky, if you want to do that, we're going to kick it over to our next full committee to allow you an opportunity to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
I would recommend that the department, if that's going to be the wishes of the representatives of the Department of Forestry Working Committee, we would not want to define logs for the purposes of cutting wood and find out that you defined it for a whole lot of other things.
Like exports.
I suspicion it is defined for exports.
Okay, we're going to carry 573 over to our next full committee work session, which may be, I'll put members on notice, but I haven't mentioned it before, possibly as soon as Monday, we may be scheduling another full committee work session, try to keep up with our subcommittee work. So, Representative Kotetsky, if you can make sure you contact Mr. Miller over at the Department of Forestry, resolve that. 2640, I think, was put on our schedule in anticipation that we would be taking that bill from the committee and using it as a vehicle on 2459. That subject area with a fiscal impact of $3 million plus dollars appears to be a dead issue. So the 2640 remains on the table unless there's any other reason to bring it off. That leaves us, we are due on the floor. I'm carrying the first bill.
I'm sorry to delay you, Mr. Chairman, but didn't, when we tabled that previous bill, we tell the Sally McCracken and others that we're going to put that into 2640?
We did. And they've been advised